This is the Tom Hartman Program.
For the Tom Hartman Book Club, our book today is How Wealth Rules the World, Saving Our Communities and Freedoms from the Dictatorship of Property by Ben G. Price, with a blurb on the back from some guy named Tom Hartman. This is from the introduction, One Right to Rule Them All, The Dark Side of Property. Let's get it out in the open. The United States of America, nations that emulate its governing principles, are governed by a dictatorship of property. Is that plutocracy? Sure, but it goes deeper than that. The U.S. Constitution, as it was written and later interpreted by the Supreme Court, hijacked democratic rights that American revolutionaries thought they had won. The Federalists developed a whole system of law that serves the interests of wealth. Elements of that system include the following: state constitutions untethered from their revolutionary moorings, international trade agreements that supersede local, state, and federal laws, regulations administered by an unrepresentative bureaucracy, political parties that gerrymander legislative districts so that they can choose their voters rather than allowing voters to choose their representatives, corporate property that the Supreme Court has declared to be persons with Bill of Rights protections, federal and state statutes that privatize public governance and prohibit democratic limits on the uses of private fortunes, and local governments declared to be property of the state and made unavailable to communities for municipal lawmaking. We live deep within an undemocratic matrix of law that masquerades as a democratic republic while it legalizes an aristocracy of wealth. The U.S. Constitution was written by men who came from a uniformly privileged class. Charles Beard argued this point in his book, An Economic Interpretation of the Constitution of the United States. Beard analyzed the economic interests of those who met in secret to overturn the Articles of Confederation and concluded that the Federalists were motivated by economic self-interest to establish a form of government that would protect their wealth against an excess of democracy, as Alexander Hamilton put it. The Federalists who replaced the Articles with the U.S. Constitution were not fully aligned with the liberating agenda of commoners who risked their lives to throw off the hierarchical chains of Great Britain. They were wealthy men educated in British law with opinions that harmonized with aristocratic sentiments. The authors of the U.S. Constitution are often called the Founding Fathers. Popular history lumps the Federalist counter-revolutionaries in with the likes of Thomas Paine, who with his firebrand writings against monarchy, nobility, and special privilege for the few, inspired the people to demand independence. Popular culture counts the Federalists as American revolutionaries no less fervent for liberty than the men whose ideas of leveling the social class system inspired American farmers and day laborers to pick up their muskets and take on the Redcoats. This conflation of the Federalist counter-revolutionaries with those whose spirit of 76 is reflected in the Declaration of Independence and absent from the U.S. Constitution is a troubling reminder that popular history too often preserves false memories. What's the evidence that the Federalists intended a constitution that weaponizes law to protect the accumulation of property and raise wealth and out of reach of public governance? Well, to begin with, their own words were recorded in Philadelphia in 1787 by James Madison and Robert Yates. Damningly, that record was held secret until every delegate to the clandestine conclave had died and the Constitution they wrote had been the law of the land for two generations. We have that evidence, and it tells the tale I'll share in Chapter 2. We also have the product of their cleverness to consider. The Federalists established a quasi-monarchical judiciary. Politically appointed judges wielded the power to veto any legislation that departs from the Federalists' original intent to protect wealthy accumulation from democratic oversight. We have the arguments of the anti-federalists who called out the would-be American aristocrats for betraying the Revolution. If not for them, we would not have the first 10 amendments to the Federalist document, the Bill of Rights, which many identify as the soul of the U.S. Constitution. More immediate evidence that the original intent of the U.S. Constitution was to immunize possession of unearned property from public regulation can be found in the antisocial way the document is interpreted by the courts and how it operates on society today. Here's my argument in a nutshell. We are faced with social, political, and environmental problems that resist resolution because law empowers a wealthy minority to govern based on priorities often at odds with the general welfare. The Constitution and its interpretation by the courts amounts to an arsenal of weaponized law able to deliver special privileges to a propertied class. Certain legal mechanisms let those seeking to profit at the public expense block policies that compete with their interests. These legal doctrines operate by a two-step process. First, they remove democratic rights from the public sphere and deposit them in concentrated accumulations of property. The oddity of attaching legal rights to property itself rather than to people roared into public consciousness with the Supreme Court's 2010 Citizens United ruling that affirmed corporate property's personhood and free speech rights. Although the ruling shocked the conscience of average Americans, it was not the first time the court had vested civil rights within inert property. Nor were corporations the first type of property to be given legal rights. The second step is for property imbued with rights to deliver those rights as an extra layer of legal privilege to the property owner. When civil and human rights are deposited in property, that property is placed beyond the authority of the people to govern how it is used by its owner. This nullifies the majority's ability to decide directly or through elected representatives what public policy will be. As a result, we aren't allowed to resolve issues of immediate concern to every community. Even when we understand what needs to be done, we're often blocked. And then he goes through the whole list. Ben G. Price writes, "How Wealth Rules the World." Right now on the line with us is Ben G. Price, the author of a new book. It's called How Wealth Rules the World, Saving Our Communities and Freedoms from the Dictatorship of Property. Ben, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks a lot for having me, Tom.
I should add, Ben is also the National Organizing Director for CELDEF, the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, CELDF.org. And howwealthruleswetheworld.com is the website, and you can tweet Ben at Ben G. Price. The dictatorship of property. I mean, you open the book in your introduction, first sentence, the first paragraph. Let's get it out in the open. The United States of America and nations that emulate its governing principles are governed by a dictatorship of property. What do you mean?
Well, I'm not talking about people who own cars and homes. We're talking about really the amassing of property, the amassing of wealth into fewer and fewer hands. But this dictator of property isn't really about the ownership itself. We certainly have a real problem with the disparity between wealth and poverty and the disparity between workers and bosses and so forth. But what we're really focusing on in the book here is that we have a system of law that favors and does a lot more than favor, actually sets up a system that allows those who control the greatest amount of wealth to have the greatest amount of governing authority. And this goes back to the Federalists who drafted the U.S. Constitution following their overturning of the Articles of Confederation and turning their backs on really the aspirations that were put forward in the Declaration of Independence by the revolutionaries.
So how does this play out today?
Well, that's the thing that I really wanted to capture in the book was the contrast between what the aspirations of revolutionaries were, what the Federalists, and just to be clear, they were counter-revolutionaries and of a quite a different stripe and opinion than the folks who fought that revolution and who should be rightly called the Founding Fathers rather than the Federalists. But also through the book, contrasting what was put together and how private law was sewn into the public law of our U.S. Constitution to protect private interests and wealth, and how that plays out today in our communities. And I've been working for about 15 years now with communities that have been trying to protect themselves against large corporate projects in the fracking fields of the U.S., the extraction of so-called natural gas. I think it's natural when it's left in the ground, not when they pull it into the open and contribute to the climate crisis that we're experiencing. But the inability of the people in our communities to engage in community self-government and to govern the behavior of people hiding behind the corporate veil with limited liability protections, which means that they're above the law. They're not responsible to the communities that they're doing harm to. And those corporations working hand in hand with our state and federal governments and being protected by our so-called justice system in ways that make it impossible for citizens to enact local laws to protect their rights, to protect their health and safety, and to protect their natural environments from destruction. It plays out in these current battles where our municipal communities are being treated like resource colonies and sacrifice zones. That's the reality of it. It's what I've seen up front and close up and personal. And it's becoming more broadly understood that the system that we're working and laboring under is, well, it's not broken. It's fixed. It's been fixed, like a crooked game of cards.
As in, the fix is in, yeah.
The fix is in. And so the question raised throughout the book and after going through how the system works, it really is about how does wealth, how does the accumulated concentration of property into fewer and fewer hands, how does that translate into a system where that 1% that's been identified, the Occupy movement, the 1% versus the 99%, how is it that that small, small minority actually gets to set policy and gets to forbid the rest of the population from standing in the way of their profit making?
Right. Well, you know, I mean, this is what Gillens and Page pointed out in that landmark study a couple of years ago, is that the interest, the legislative interests of the top 1% have something like a 70% correlation between what they want and what they get. The top 10%, it's like a 60% correlation or something like that, if I'm remembering right. I'm guessing you probably know this much better than me. And for the bottom 90%, there is literally no correlation between what they want and what Congress passed as legislation. In fact, the phrase that they used was that it was the equivalent of random noise. It is completely, you know, the desires of the bottom 90% are completely ignored by our political system. So short of rewriting our Constitution, which ain't going to happen any day soon, what do we do?
Well, it absolutely, that study illustrates just those things. But what has been needed since then, and it was what I was concerned about, is why is it, not just why, but how does that process work? What are the mechanisms? And is it just corruption? Is it just buying off legislators and judges? And no, the answer is that even if we elect the perfect pal of democracy, put him in their office, and you find that, you know, the program that they're allowed to run in terms of governing process does not allow them to create the outcomes that actually represent the interests of the majority. You know, it's true that we're not going to overturn or change the U.S. Constitution overnight. The one thing that has been happening, and I've been working with communities at the local level for 15 years now, is that they've been enacting local laws that challenge the system, that challenge the claim that rights that are vested in corporate property, you know, the idea that that whole corporate personhood thing, we get lost in that. We get lost in what's wrong with Citizens United and so forth. And I'd say that if we overturned Citizens United, we would not have done nearly enough to fix the problems that we face.
No, I get that. I get that.
Yeah.
You know, totally. But from the point of view of a person who's listening to this interview right now, who's thinking, okay, in the next, you know, year and a half as we're running up to this election, I can do something. I can lobby my legislators. I can get my friends to sign petitions. Where should they be focusing their attention? Or I can campaign for a particular candidate who's talking about changing the system in ways that are more consonant with what you're talking about, Ben. What is your advice to that person?
Tom, I'm going to say something that may be controversial, and that is that begging the legislators that have enacted the laws that keep us in the box and control is probably not going to get us what we want. That voting your favorite candidate into office may improve things compared to where they are, but it's not going to change the system.
So what should people do then?
No. We have to do what the civil rights activists did. We have to confront the obstruction of democracy. We have to do lunch counter sit-ins, if you will, but that's not the model. That's the type of thing.
So what's the model?
We have to bring attention to the fact that we're being deprived of the right of self-determination in places where we live. And that means making local law that is, even if it's preempted by the state or federal government, if it is in protection of the rights of the people and to protect our own home base, our environment.
No, I get that, Ben, and I'm totally supportive of you and the work that CELDEF are doing, and CELDEF has been, you know, helping communities pass these laws all over the country, but you've never had one that was sustained.
Well, we don't expect any more than under Plessy versus Ferguson that made segregation by race perfectly legal and constitutional, according to the Supreme Court. During years and years after the Civil War, we thought we had ended slavery and right. What we had is apartheid. What could possibly change that? Well, not asking the courts if it would be okay if we ignore what they've said wasn't okay, and that was integration. So we have to turn our backs on the courts. This is controversial.
Although it was the court that overturned Plessy in Brown v. Board.
Well, not until the towns were in an uproar, not until the people had stood up and said, we will not accept this.
Right.
And the courts have been pretty studious about reversing and chipping away at those decisions from the late 50s and early 60s as well, and the Voters' Rights Act and so forth. And so what we didn't get, interestingly, what we didn't get when the courts ruled on those decisions was an absolute constitutional right of the people not to be discriminated against. Right. What we got was decisions that were grounded in the Commerce Clause that said that businesses that engaged in commerce could not discriminate.
Great book, How Wealth Rules the World by Ben Price. Check out celdef.org too, celdef.org, and check out the extraordinary work that they're doing. It is a long, long battle.
Thank you, Tom.
Good talking with you.